Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the Al Franken Podcast. We got a great one today for a change. Our guest is Chris Rock. Chris, thank you for doing this.
Al, it's great. No problem.
Yeah.
Doing what? We're just talking. Would you?
I do a lot of research for these things.
Yes. Okay.
What I find the best way to research someone I'm interviewing is to Google them. And then put in quotes.
Okay.
And go to their quotes.
That's, yeah.
I found one which it was one about basically that you have your own demons and stuff. And I'm and the reason I ask this is not, I don't want to know anything about that.
Right,
I don't want to know a damn thing about that.
Right, right, right.
It's just like, where the hell did that fucking quote come from? Was that one of these?
I don't know. What's the quote?
Oh, I have my own demons and devils and... Okay.
I mean, some of these are not me. Sometimes it's like Chris Tucker or Chappelle. It's like, I didn't say that. Robert Townsend said that. You know, but
I have the feeling that there are these kinds of profiles where they ask you that, right?
I guess. I mean, I haven't done these things in a while, but...
You stopped doing some things that you used to do because?
You know.
You don't have to?
Partly you don't have to. As the great Lorne Michaels once said, you can't make an entrance if you never leave.
Ah, that's good.
So, yeah.
So you have to leave every once
in a while. You got to leave. You want people to...
Well, that's what I've just done.
Cause a... That's what this whole thing was about.
Boy, did I do that in a spectacular way.
Spectacular fashion.
Yeah, wasn't that? Wow.
There you go.
Lauren, if you're listening, I took your advice.
There you go.
Lauren. So, okay, let's talk about the show. That's where we met, the show.
SNL, Saturday Night Live.
Yep. I had been there a while. You're a founding member. That's right.
You're like... in the original Temptations, kind of.
Yes. Are there any Temptations when you see the Temptations?
I think the guy with the really bassy voice is still in it. Otis or whatever his name is.
Wow. Okay, let me ask you something you might not know. The original members of America?
I...
You don't know that.
I don't know.
One of my favorite things that you... have done, and there are many, many of those. But one of my favorite things was when you were at the Oscars and went to a Magic Johnson theater.
Yeah.
And because it was so crystallizing, because you went to the Magic Johnson theater and no one there had ever heard of any
of the Oscar movies. I mean, you could do that at a lot of theaters.
Well, that was partly your point.
You can do that at most.
You went to a Magic Johnson theater in a neighborhood that was a black neighborhood.
Yes,
but
you could do that in most white neighborhoods. People would not know what Amelie is.
Right.
Yeah. If you went to most white theaters and started going, what did you like, Match Point or Crimes and Misdemeanors? Aren't they derivatives?
but on the Upper West Side of New York.
Yeah.
But there would be a heated
discussion, but that's a small slither of New York.
So I think you're pointing out a couple things. One, which is that the Oscar picks, I mean, they're trying to pick the best films artistically, right? Is that,
yeah.
That's what
I mean, I guess.
And so Americans' taste doesn't necessarily, whether you're in Terre Haute or whether you're at a Magic Johnson Theater in L.A.,
right,
it doesn't tend toward the nomination. But I think especially so
at the Magic Johnson Theater.
And especially so with the old Academy.
Especially so with the old Academy, yes.
And so the new Academy.
The new Academy is still heavily the old Academy. It's just they let some new people in, but I don't think they
Are we talking in code?
It's not like there's a black Academy. It's just, you know, they let some people in, but.
No, I know. I don't think there is
a new Academy.
Now, hosting the Oscars.
Yes.
Intimidating or not?
It's intimidating, don't get me wrong. Okay. I mean, it's still harder to host any episode of Saturday Night Live than hosting the Oscars.
Well, you have to do less.
You have to do less than hosting the Oscars.
And you have to have a little...
And one thing is kind
of... How many times have you hosted SNL?
I've hosted SNL twice, and I've hosted the Oscars twice. And the Oscars are way easier than SNL.
Yeah, because you do a monologue, and that's it, right?
Right, and by the way, your monologue is held to a standard of the other Oscar hosts. I mean, Billy Crystal and Steve Martin are, you know, some of the funniest guys ever grace the earth. But on most days, I can be funnier than Hugh Jackman.
Yes.
Most days. Some days, he kicks my ass. But most days.
So, SNL.
Yeah.
How long were you with
I was on
show?
SNL 3 years.
Three seasons. Then you went to In Living Color
To In Living Color right away, and then that got canceled. Yes.
Okay.
Because I'm so smart.
Well, I think you've been smart, but I think that very often when I see you,
yeah,
you bring up Tim McCarver.
I love Tim McCarver. Caught for Steve Carlton.
A great Hall of Fame catcher. MVP 1 year.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I can tell this. You want to tell the story?
Well, the story. I forget.
Okay, this is it. We're in on a Monday before the 5 o'clock meeting, right?
Right.
We're in where they have the read through table.
Yes.
We're sitting around. We're throwing around a few ideas before the meeting with the host. That's the first meeting of the week, and you say, "I'm cool. I killed on Saturday. I killed." And you were like, really, you just said, I have no pressure on me at all. I'm fine. I don't have to think of anything. And I said, Chris, and I know you love baseball. I just read an article by Tim McCarver, the catcher for the Cardinals. And he said that there were some batters in the league that if they got a hit early in the game, they knew they were easier to get out later in the game. And that, and this was the kicker, that the pitcher knew it and he knew it. And if they're two out, nobody on early in the game, they'd give him a hit, essentially. I'm assuming this is not a power hitter. Yeah. So they give a guy just put her right over the middle, let the guy get a hit. And then they knew... When it came up later in the game, he would relax, and they could get him out easier. And the reason I bring this up is that you bring it up so often to me, and I'm raising it because it makes me look great. First and foremost. But also, I think you work incredibly hard.
I do work incredibly
hard.
And
that couldn't have been... That can't be the turning point where a light bulb went off and said, I don't want to be that guy. No one wants to be that
guy. I do
guy.
Not want to be that guy. But, I'll say this, what it was. We have this, the culture now, it's so weird. No one thinks they deserve the job they have. I was like, I can't believe I'm on this show. I can't believe, I'm so grateful to be here. And I see a lot of that.
You do?
Yeah. Okay. So I used to have that same head where it's like, I was just so lucky to be at SNL as opposed to like, hey, I deserve to be here and make the most of this.
Oh.
So it got me out of the head of, I'm so happy to be here, this great legacy, I can't believe Lorne Michaels speaks to me. Like, all of that shit had to be gone.
Okay, okay.
And I had to act like somebody who's actually in the league.
Wow. That's deeper than I thought it was.
You know what I mean? You know, I don't want to.
It still isn't.
It's not a black. It's not a minority thing, but that does happen with a lot of minorities, I would imagine, or women, or just people that feel anybody that feels
aren't white men
that you feel like I'm so lucky to be here, and that's not the most conducive attitude to greatness.
What's interesting is when you said I think most people think I don't deserve to be here, and I'm a white man, and I don't know anybody.
Yeah, that's or think that you're lucky to be there, and that's just a bad attitude to have. It's just not an attitude that's.
I think
conducive.
Having gratitude,
absolutely,
is very important in life.
Having gratitude is very, very, very important.
Those are two different things.
But you should also, Michael Jordan has to know he's Michael Jordan.
I think he. Did
well, I did
a piece on that. I did the Stuart Smalley piece in which Stuart didn't know who he was, and had him do an affirmation.
Michael, I know there must be a lot of pressure for you to play very well, and I can imagine that a night before a game, you must lie awake thinking, I'm not good enough, everybody's better than me. I'm not going to score any points. I have no business playing this game.
Well, not really.
Michael, denial ain't just a river in Egypt.
When he hosted the show, it was the first time they had allowed NBA pros in the Olympics.
Yeah.
And I was in his dressing room, and I just went, so how do you think that's going to go? And go, oh. It's nothing. We're going to clobber everybody. And they did. He was a great guy. He wasn't arrogant, but he did not have a confidence problem. Also, I would say that if you're talking about people of color in a profession, I don't think black guys are going like, I am so lucky to be here. In the same league that Bob Cousy played in. Well,
even comedians, you see it all the time. It's like, does this guy know how good he is?
Okay, might as well go with it. Who's a comedian?
I don't want to call anybody out, but there's definitely people that you know are capable of greatness, but are just, their minds are fixated on survival. And it's like, you're so beyond survival.
Like, I got it.
You don't even understand how good you are.
I think what the event that established your greatness would be the HBO stand-up. Am I wrong?
It'd be wrong for me to sit here and go, great.
You're right. That'd be ridiculous.
I don't ever want to be on record as going, yes, I was great then. No, I did my thing.
Okay, the thing that the event that elevated your career the most significantly, no?
Yes, it captured what I did and what I was meant to do.
And you really, people hadn't seen it before.
People hadn't seen it. I mean, also, I was just, when I got to SNL, I was really young. I was really young. I didn't know Second City existed. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know what improv clubs, I didn't know what any of that stuff was.
But when did you start doing stand-up?
I was probably doing stand-up about 6-7 years when I got SNL. I just didn't know what I was doing. I was just, like, shoved into this thing.
Yeah, I remember that, actually. I do remember that.
I was just young. I'd never had a job. Like,
I hadn't really had a job, like a real job until I had SNL.
And, I was, like, shoved into it. I was the first black cast member in 9 years since Damon was fired.
Oh, yeah.
And really, he wasn't on that long. So I was more or less the black guy after Eddie Murphy, which kind of put a weird pressure on me.
Because Eddie was very young as well.
He was very, he's the best that ever did it. So it's just like, wow.
So when you did that, what happened? What happened?
What happened?
What happened?
How did I get good?
Yeah. what happened?
I mean, I quit show business, essentially. Like, I'd been on SNL. I'd been on Living Color. I was in the movie New Jack City.
I remember that, yeah.
I had a movie CB4. Like, I'd done a lot of stuff, and people pretty much assumed they knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, no one was calling me for anything. The Def Comedy Jam had come out, and I knew my career was, like, in the shitter because it was February, and I had no gigs. Now, if you're a black comedian in February, you play college. It's Black History Month. You can't.
Trying to put that together.
Yeah, there's just too much work in February.
So that's like college. Being, like, an Irish musician on St. Patrick's Day and not getting a gig.
Yes. So, like, what? I have no gigs in February. I'm in trouble. Mm-hmm. What the fuck is going on?
That's a metric.
It's a metric. So I just made a conscious decision to just kind of put my head down and just go to the comedy clubs and just do stand-up at a ridiculous rate of,
several clubs a night.
Just every night, every road gig I could possibly take. I just worked more than everybody. And not just working more than everybody. I didn't think anybody was going to give me a job in show business. So I was never really trying to get a job. I was just saying what was in my heart.
So that was really what did it. Because there was an enormous difference in the subject matter, in the tone, you were.
I'd grown. I was just...
And there you talked a lot about race and different...
And relationships and stuff. I mean, stand-up comedy is not music. With the exception of Eddie Murphy, there is no Justin Bieber of stand-up comedy. This is like...
Are you saying you can't sing the same song? I mean, you can't tell the same joke?
No one is ever broken in their 20s. It just hasn't. It just never happens. You can be kind of funny. You can be, Pete Davidson in Work or whatever. But no one listens to you as a comedian. Really listens to you.
I'm trying to think through this and prove you wrong, but I can't.
I was always a kid when I was on SNL.
I see what you're saying.
Like, I was never trying to be a grown man. So I got good, but part of it was I was growing as a person and. My dad had died, and I was in a relationship, and I had a mortgage, and you know what I mean?
You were actually becoming an adult.
I was actually becoming an adult that, you're an adult. You warrant being listened to a little bit.
But it seemed like you're talking about, not just talking about slightly heavier topics, but that you were incredibly insightful about them, in ways that people hadn't heard, not just from you, but from anyone.
If that's how they feel, fine. I learned a lot from you guys. One thing I did learn at SNL was how to write. Just because something's funny doesn't mean it's good. sometimes.
Yeah, I try to explain that.
You know what I mean? Just because people are laughing, like, there's different qualities of humor, you know? Just because it's funny doesn't mean you should say it, you know? So I did learn that. I learned that from you, and I learned that from Odenkirk, and I learned that from Conan. And
Downey.
And Downey, and, yeah, you know, it's like, okay.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm very curious,
what are you curious about
your grandfather.
My grandfather
was a preacher, right?
Alan Rock, yes, preacher, yes.
And I read somewhere that you used to hang with him when he wrote his sermons.
Well, he drove a cab. One great thing about my grandfather, killed a man.
It was totally justified, right?
Well, I mean,
please.
He's a preacher, so...
He's a preacher, so yes.
Preachers, you know...
No, I don't know. Rabbis that I know don't kill people.
Preachers are, known to be a little handsy. It's like, you take me to a Baptist church and I'll point out a kid in the congregation that looks a little too much like the preacher.
Ah.
My grandfather allegedly liked to sleep around. So people that cheat, one thing about cheaters, they're jealous. So my grandfather thought my grandmother was sleeping with the guy next door. So he confronts the guy next door and goes, if you step another foot in my yard, I'll kill you. If you step another foot in my yard, I'll blow you away. And the guy took one step in and my grandfather shot him, killed him.
Now, did grandpa
in Brooklyn
spend some time?
He spent some time in jail. I believe it got knocked down to a manslaughter thing, which is, 6-7 years. Not
how
we walk by people that committed manslaughter every day.
Okay, what neighborhood is this?
This is Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy. This was the heart of Bed-Stuy. But yeah, my grandfather gets out of jail.
So that's very different than where I grew up.
A little bit.
I grew up in St. Louis Park,
right,
which is a suburb of Minneapolis. And it was about 20% Jewish. It was the Jewish suburb. Tom Friedman, the Coen brothers.
Hey.
You know? And, a lot of people think, like, Fargo was the Coen brothers just making fun of Gentiles. And that's exactly what it was.
Anyway, my grandfather used to drive us to school. You know, New York, back when... there was a real labor movement. There'd be strikes quite often. back when the worker had power, there'd be strikes occasionally. And, sometimes the school bus drivers would go on strike. Anyway, my grandfather would drive us to school. And he'd be writing his sermons all week. And I would watch him doodle his sermon. And then I'd have to go to church on Sunday. And I just kind of noticed that he never wrote the sermon. It was just always like these talking points,
right,
that he would write down and put them
in. Which is why it had a flow and sounded...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was,
music. It was almost music.
It was almost music. And then, his pad was, kind of guardrails, just to make sure he didn't go too crazy off the thing. So I guess I went from a guy trying to write jokes to, like, more of that. Like, okay, this is probably a better style for me. More of a conversational thing. And here we are.
Okay, and how do you develop that? In other words, I mean, you're saying you go to club, lots of clubs.
You got
to
get on stage all the time. And you also, it takes a lot of confidence because you got to, like, the average stand-up, what was it? You get a laugh every 8 seconds or 10 seconds or whatever. But the good stand-ups can go minutes and minutes without getting any laughs, which sounds, it sounds backwards.
Something.
Yeah, which sounds backwards. But the good guys, the longer you would think, you know, oh, the most laughs you get per minute is the best comedian. No.
Because those are one-liners and...
Yeah, just some guys that do one-liners, but the people that can delay... It, just like in life, if you can delay the gratitude, it's so much bigger. Chappelle's really good at it right now, where he's just like, I have no idea where he's going, but I'm very captivated.
He right now can get away with pretty much anything. And he's got the courage to do that.
I always say this. It's only controversial if your audience finds it controversial.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, if the people that like you like it, then what's the problem? If people that don't necessarily like you don't like something, what? Okay. So I'm only worried when I offend people that like me. I don't really care.
I was in a world for a while there where you had to get a majority of people to at least vote for you.
Yes.
And that's different.
Show business is different now. It's just you have your congregation and I mean, you can try to get more people.
That wasn't show business that I was in that part of my life.
You were in show business, though.
Oh, I was. Okay.
You don't think it was show business.
Yeah. I think that's why I was kind of good at it, actually.
Who's the president of the United States? A guy who was in the number one show in the country.
I found that having been a performer was incredibly useful in hearings.
Yeah. No, just any crowd work.
I just love the term, like, okay, we've brought Chris Rock into the caucus, and he's going to tell us how to do
whenever I'm on tour, I won't out anybody, but all the biggest preachers in the country come to my shows.
Of course.
And they always come through the back. They always find some... slokey way of getting in the theater without anybody seeing them. And you know what we talk about? Crowd work. We just talk about performing.
Okay, what is crowd work?
I'm just saying, even just working a crowd. We just talk about performing. If I was talking to the Pope right now, we would talk about working an audience. Getting an audience, grabbing them, when you know you're losing them. How do you get them back?
Okay. Walk us through some of that.
I DJed before I was a comedian. I was a DJ, played block parties and house parties and stuff. I was really young, but the guys I worked with were all like 5-10 years older than me, but they, they like cocaine. They like to get high. So I was like this kid that was relatively straight, that they knew once they were really fucked up, I could man the boards.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. You're the designated operator.
I could spin records, and they just knew I could be counted on.
Right.
But I remember one night, I don't know, it was, rap music's just starting out, and it's late, and I probably played like 5 hardcore rap records in a row, and one of the older guys snaps out of his high and goes, what the fuck is wrong with you? You're trying to get us killed? Because you couldn't play You can't play five up-tempo records in a row, especially in an urban crowd. You have to calm the crowd down.
Ah, really?
Yeah, you have to calm the crowd. And this is even at a festival. It's like, okay, we got to calm. Crowds are dangerous. You have to calm them down.
Wow.
And I even learned that with jokes. Like, okay, they can handle four of these. Let me take it down a notch. Before I get to this other material.
Can you think of something from your last special where you had four of some kind of thing in a row and then went,
even like racial things. It's like, okay, I can get white people to laugh at two of these right now.
Okay.
But if I do the third one, there's going to be some guy's going to curse me out and there's going to be a fight and, you know, and the ushers are going to have to come and whatever.
Makes
sense, right?
Yeah. Your audiences, I know you play different places, but your audiences, how do they break down?
It's pretty mixed. It depends on if I'm in Minnesota, there's a bunch of white people. If I'm in Atlanta, there's a bunch of black people. It's, you know, it varies. You know, when you're in Biloxi, Mississippi, you better watch yourself a little bit. You gotta like.
Well, you think there'd be a lot of black people there.
There are a lot of black people Biloxi. There, but but the kind of white people that are there are like, okay, I can take two of these, but you know.
Okay. I'm just thinking of a white person who comes to your show in Biloxi, you'd think is. Going like,
and every now and then you don't know who's dragged by their girlfriend or you know, whatever. No crowd smarter than another crowd. Okay.
Mobs are mobs.
Mobs are mobs. Right. I don't care.
They lose their brain.
If you're at Rikers Island or in front of a bunch of senators, you have the ability
to make
these people.
A bunch of senators acting kind of like a mob.
Yeah. It literally crowds. You get the smartest person and you divide the IQ by the number of people in the place. It just gets dumber and dumber. I mean, and by the way, I say it in a respectful way. If I can tell smarter jokes playing the Beacon Theater than I can playing Madison Square Garden.
Oh, it's a sign. I see.
See okay. what I'm saying? Yep. Like, when you play Madison Square Garden, when you're in front of 20,000 people, nuance goes out the window.
Is there anything to do with the acoustics?
I mean, some of it's the acoustics, something about the mood. It's so easy to lose 20,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't go, okay, well, what are we going to talk about now? Hecklers start you have to be on it in every way in front of 20,000 people where you can kind of think in front of you play the Apollo, even though everybody's black audience is hard. You can think out loud. You can think out loud.
And they'll follow you and be with you. Right.
Yeah. So
you've played 20,000.
Yes.
Gosh, that must be something when it's working.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's great.
Unbelievable.
It's great.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now you're doing Fargo coming next.
I am doing Fargo. I start that in about 3 weeks. Yeah.
What do you play in Fargo?
I play a mob boss.
Where?
In St. Louis.
Oh, okay.
St. Louis, yeah.
Because originally Fargo was a Minnesota thing, but now it becomes... They change every year what they...
They do kind of change every year. It's a whole new show every year. This one is in St. Louis. I mean, I guess we'll make it to Fargo. I've only read like three scripts. So at some point we'll be in Minnesota, but...
Fargo, of course, is in North Dakota.
North Dakota, sorry about that.
No, I...
Public school
education. I represented Minnesota, so yeah. I know...
Fargo, yeah.
Yeah, it's Fargo, Moorhead. Moorhead is the other side of the Red River.
I didn't go to fancy school, so...
Red River, the north.
It's rough. Occasionally, my GED flares up.
You know how you got to school...
How to get to school?
In a bus.
I did get to school on a bus. Yes, I did.
Let's go to the bus now, and then we'll come back to acting. Okay. Because that came up in the debates. It came up, but it's like, hasn't been an issue, what, for 40
years? I don't even know people are still being bused. I mean, I guess I see school buses when I'm...
Oh, there are school buses. Yes, there are still school buses. But they aren't integrating...
I thought we stopped that. I thought that was just...
Well, there's a number of reasons. One, people hated it.
Right.
Including you, right?
I hated it, yeah. I didn't like it. I mean, I was bused. I've said this before. It was, it's like an hour from my house. You're at school competing with kids that got an hour more sleep than you. That's like, that's your school. Okay. They got an hour more sleep than you. They have, so it's an hour.
They may have really gotten 2 hours more sleep because you got to go an hour back.
Right. They have 10 more free hours a week than you because you're they have a whole day you don't have. They have a whole day to do homework or whatever that you don't have, right? Mm-hmm. You can't socialize because you have to get on a freaking bus. Not that anybody wanted to socialize with me.
Tell me about that aspect of it.
I was welcomed with open arms? I was the only black boy in my grade. It was horrible. But, hey, made me who I am. You know how many kids asked me to, come back to their house and whatever would be called a play date nowadays?
They knew you had to get on the bus.
No. How many? Okay. so second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth. Like, in 9 years.
Yeah.
In 9 years of, white schools, how many times was I invited to anything? I mean, you could go to a birthday party on the weekend or something. Mm-hmm. How many times do you think I was invited, Al?
Okay, I'm going to say 10, because it'd be more than one a year.
Once. Only once.
Who was that?
Davey Moskowitz.
I like that you remember.
Oh, do I remember? How could I forget Davey Moskowitz? Davey Moskowitz, man, invited me junior high. So, we were taking city buses at that point. And I went back to his house, and we played Rock'em Sock'em Robots or some shit, I forget. And we had sandwiches, and it was great. And I remember his father coming in and doing a double take of me in the living room. But otherwise, it was fine. But literally, one kid. I never got invited to anything.
That's why I thought that whole thing in that debate was just weird. Because Senator Harris does not support federal busing now. No one really does, I don't think.
I don't think so.
So all... Oops. Biden was saying, you got a phone call?
Can I take Scott Rutan?
Oh, yes.
Let me take Scott Rutan.
Here, just put him on speaker so we can hear him.
Yeah.
Oh, one of the biggest producers in Hollywood is calling.
Yeah, yeah. The creator of the British version. The creator of the British version. He said he had a falling out with you, but I said that everybody. That's Al Franken laughing. Yeah. All right.
Bye. Oh, Okay.
Looks like I'm doing a movie.
Yeah, great. Now, I just want the audience to know that you've heard one side of a real live Hollywood showbiz call, right? Scott Rudin, one of the biggest producers in the movies, right?
In the history of movies, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah, he's the real guy. He's so good.
Can you say?
I can't really say.
Oh, okay. But it's big. I understand that.
It's big. I mean, it could be. I mean, it's show business. So what no one understands is 97% of things don't happen.
Right. So you have to have a lot of plates spinning, right?
You got
to
have a lot of plates spinning. So a successful person in show business is a person that bats 118.
I see.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, my God, he's always got stuff happening. It's like nothing ever happens. But
I remember when Tom Davis and I got to SNL, and this is before the show started, right? And by the time it was cast with, you know, Garrett and Chevy and Belushi and Aykroyd and Jane Lorraine and Gilda, and the writers around us that we had, and I remember saying to Tom, this show's going to be an enormous hit. And I was 24 years old, and I did not know that there is never an enormous hit.
Right.
And that it was like the stupidest thing for anyone to say.
Every year, 30 pilots air, and maybe want to hit every 3 years. Like, nothing works.
But I was right because I was so ignorant.
You know, the ignorance worked in your favor.
Yeah.
No.
I was supremely confident.
If you had any idea the real odds, it would have actually affected your output.
It might have. But I said, Tom, don't you see, this is the first time our generation has been allowed to write and to be on. This is a countercultural show. This is going to be huge. And Tom, who is smarter than me, went, yeah.
Oh, Tom.
Yeah. Okay, we were talking about about Fargo. So
before can't get any artsy, we're talking about the show Fargo. Scott Rudin calls. It's highbrow. That's what I'm trying to say. We're in the highbrow world.
This is a highbrow movie you're talking about?
I'm saying, yeah, everything's highbrow right now. Fargo's a pretty highbrow show. Pretty good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fargo is very highbrow.
Very highbrow.
But would the movie that you're just talking with Rudin about be seen at a Magic Johnson theater?
Yes.
It would be.
Yes, it would be seen at a Magic Johnson theater.
Okay. So it's highbrow and be at a Magic Johnson theater. So it really sounds big.
That's me. That's my brand. If brand's not, you know, it can be such an obnoxious word. But, yeah, that's me.
Now, he said that he had a falling out with you, but
with
that's
somebody
everybody.
Else. Yeah, and it's just everybody has a falling out with Scott.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's just Scott.
So I once, this is a story I heard once. A friend of mine, the screenwriter, is at his office, and it's right before Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival.
Right.
And there is an assistant, a new assistant that Rudin has, among a number of assistants. And he gets a hotel room for, like, a huge star at Cannes who couldn't get a hotel room.
Right.
And he said, oh, you know what? It just fell into my lap. You know, you're welcome, but honestly, it just happened to fall in the lap. But, you know, I'm glad we were able to do that for you. And then he hangs up. So Rudin goes to the kid and says, don't you ever tell anyone that it was easy to get him a room. You tell him you worked your ass off to get it.
He's right.
Absolutely right.
He's right.
And this kid is smarter for it. That kid now
runs Disney.
Yes.
That's how it works out. I remember I was talking to Jay-Z one time. Jay-Z famously doesn't write. It comes up at the top of his head. So he goes in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Timberland or Pharrell or whoever plays him a beat. And he kind of comes up with the raps kind of on, you know, top of his head, kind of like.
So he just goes into the studio.
Goes in the booth, has on headphones like us right now. And, I mean, he'll rap over a record several times until it feels right to him.
Right.
But he always, and he likes to tell people he doesn't write. And I was like, just me trying to, being an idiot, trying to, it's like, no one wants to hear that we didn't work on this steak. Like, you want to go to a restaurant and you're like, yeah, we don't really cook this at all. We just throw it on your plate. No, we make it up even if we.
Well, he's writing when he's doing that. Anyway, that's writing.
Yeah. He likes to tell you how easy it comes to him.
And oh, what's the feeling that's supposed to give you?
I'm not sure.
Inadequacy.
Maybe that. whatever. And I'm
talent
lack. So I believe. Don't tell anybody. Yeah. So easy.
I don't know him, so.
He's a great guy. I've had really good relationship mentors.
What movies of his have you done?
We did a play. The first time I worked on, we did a play, The Motherfucker with the Hat, on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Me, Annabelle Sciorra, Bobby Cannavale, Yul Vasquez, Elizabeth Rodriguez, whatever. Nominated for a Tony that year for Best Play. Several nominations. We did the movie Top 5 that I directed years ago. Name drop Bill. I was having lunch with Mamet.
David Mamet, the playwright and screenwriter.
And we were talking about me doing a play for Mamet. And scheduling or whatever didn't work out. But Mamet...
I've had other guests, former energy secretary, Ernie Moniz, did a play with Mamet.
Oh, there you go. It's pretty cool. Anyway, Mamet gave me a script to read. It was a take on Kurosawa's High and Low.
Okay.
And I read it, and I liked it, but I had notes, but I don't want to give Mamet notes.
Okay.
It's like, who am I to give, you know, David Mamet? It's as good as they come, right? So I was meeting with Scott about something else, and I gave him the notes because I knew he was working
producing?
On the script
okay.
with Mamet. Anyway, Scott likes my notes so much that...
he fires Mamet.
Kind of, yeah. So I guess Mike Nichols was supposed to direct it. And he goes, you want to have lunch? I get a call 3 weeks later. You want to have lunch with me and Mike Nichols? Like, yeah, I'll have lunch with the guy that... Did sure. The graduate? Why not?
Yeah, and lots of other...
lots of other things. You know, and they kind of sit me down and offer me this writing gig based on my notes I gave to Scott. And it's to this day the only writing gig I've ever taken. But I figured I'd get some lunches with Mike Nichols out of it, which I absolutely got.
And was the thing made?
No, it was not made. Mike died. I don't know where.
That's when he died.
I don't know where it's at now, but.
Well, as you say.
So anyway, that's
very few things happen.
Very few things happen. Yeah, Mike died. That movie didn't happen. I was supposed to do Robert Altman's last movie.
died.
Yeah, he was. You ever see the documentary Hands on Hard Body?
No.
There's a weird competition in some part of Texas. And the competition's been, how long can you keep your hand on this Cadillac? You're talking people hand, how hard it is to keep your hand on a Cadillac for 16 hours or 20 hours. Like, people fall out. It's the weird. You should watch the documentary.
And do you get the Cadillac
if you get the Cadillac? Or you get like 10 grand or whatever.
How many people are doing this?
It's, I don't know, 6-7 people.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, you should see the documentary. It's so fascinating. Robert Altman was doing a scripted version of this great documentary. And I remember talking to him a lot about my character. Then one day he just died in the movie. Just didn't happen. So there you go.
You got to maybe start working with younger...
I should.
Younger, like, collaborators or directors. So
great guys. Both of them, really great guys. So Scott Rutan's been really instrumental.
Well, Chris, thank you for doing this.
Hey, Al. You know, Tim McCarver story. I mean, I'm in your debt.
You owe everything.
I owe everything to you. Well, and you know, Davey Moskowitz. I just remember everyone that was nice to me in life.
Well, it sounds like from your school years, it's one person. From your, at least from your classmates.
Yeah, just
I remember
Davey Moskowitz.
Davey Moskowitz.
Davey
now,
Moskowitz.
Have you got in touch with
oh,
Davey?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
When
so.
I'm on tour, and he lives in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
Davey Moskowitz is the motherfucking man. He's got, you want Chris Rock tickets? Davey Moskowitz is your guy.
God bless him.
God bless him.
Well, this show goes out to Davey Moskowitz.
Yeah, good guy.
Sounds Jewish.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say. Yeah.
Okay, so the only one who invited you.
Hey, I got no problem.
Was the Jew.
Always the nicest to me.
Rudin?
Rudin, hey.
Jew.
I got no, you know.
Warren Michaels?
Hey.
Jew.
I got no,
So, you're welcome.
On behalf
of...
These people have been very good to me.
The chosen people.
I played Israel last year, 2 years ago.
How did that go?
It went really good.
Yeah?
I gotta say.
And were they... They must have been very familiar with you.
I played like a hockey arena, some big arena. It was not
where,
like
in
a,
Tel Aviv?
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't like a little place. It was pretty... I played a couple of shows.
Did you do any... special material for Israel? You must have.
I had Jeff Ross on the road with me. You
know, uh-huh. Jeff? Yeah, sure.
So I right now I don't even remember what my opening line was.
Did he open?
He opened the show.
Oh, he opened. Well, then you got your...
Yeah, he opened the show. But I can't even remember what I said, but he told me, okay, if you say this, you'll be fine. He's like, you sure, Jeff?
Yeah. Shout out to the settlers.
Whatever he told me to say, I said it. Verbatim, like I had it written at the lip of the stage.
Uh-huh.
Just big laugh every night, and then I just go into my act.
I see. Like, okay. Yeah, well, that's
Jeff Ross.
Jeff Ross, he's brilliant.
Jeff Ross is a brilliant
really
guy.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
As are you, my friend. And thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get out of here.
All right.
All right.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.